I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to present my work, and above everything, I'd like to thank you for still being here for the last talk, the last day. Okay, so quantum coherence and tunneling in nanomagnets. I've profited enormously from interactions with the Grenoble group, and particularly Bernard Barber and Rafik Ballou and Wolfgang Wernstoffer. Okay, so what do I want to talk about? I'll give some sort of introduction, which maybe isn't necessary after what we just heard. I'd like to introduce a couple of other subjects that I'd like to interest experimentalists in looking at. How does the quantum pencil fall? Schrodinger's cats and nanomagnets. But I want to spend quite a bit of time on trying to convince you that we should be thinking about intermediate spin, whatever that is. Then I'll want to discuss, both in terms of the coherent spin formalism a little bit, and during in terms of auxiliary particles, which actually generate real wave functions, the phenomena that goes on in iron 8. I doubt whether I'll get to coherence and intermediate spin effects in antiferromagnets. Okay, so why am I interested in this subject? Well, this is Pinch from Physics Today in Zurich. One's interested in seeing how the transition between classical and quantum mechanics comes about, and I think a lot of you here would consider spin 10 as pretty much classical, so we must be sitting somewhere on this boundary, and we can perhaps get some ideas of what is involved in that transition. This is, I think, picked off the IBM site from Rutger. This might be the hard drive of the future and this is really a magnetic force microscope for doing ESR, but you can get to detection levels approaching single spins. I'll come back to cantilevers and magnetic moments when I get to cats. Usually one tries to separate two phenomena. One is quantum coherence and the other is quantum tunneling. Quantum coherence will associate with the idea that if you have a double well potential like that, the ground state in quantum mechanics has a splitting in it, where classically the ground states would be degenerate, and quantum tunneling as being the phenomena that's more like alpha particle decay, although usually in a magnetic particle there's something over here that stops the particle from escaping. So this is going from a classically stable but quantum mechanically unstable well into a lower level. Well, for quantum coherence, it used to be that the best evidence for seeing this was in ferritin, and this is the experimental results of the group of Ashelong, which you don't see him anymore, until perhaps the results on iron 8 that we already heard about. We already heard quite a bit about this molecule. This is manganese 12 again. This has been used to study extensively the second kind of phenomena, as explained by the previous speaker. You have to decide what sort of model you want to describe the system with, and explain pretty clearly. Again, you have to ask questions about the symmetry, and for manganese 12, the symmetry is such that the tunneling comes about from these S plus S minus terms raised to the power 4. So let's say a little bit what's going on. Because there's a negative sign here, the dominant energy is the D, and that wants to make the spin point either up or down. And with a magnetic field along the Z direction, nothing would happen. This would be a good quantum state, and that would be a good quantum state. But the plus-minus terms connect together states that differ by M, or SZ, that differs by 4, and that allows the states, in particular the plus and minus 10 levels, to be coupled together and give a splitting in much the same way as you would in the double well. So to a certain extent, the higher order crystal field terms, either this, which is appropriate to manganese 12, or this, which is appropriate to iron 8, are the kinetic energy in the problem.
How does this connect to minus 10 to plus 6?
Oh. 16, that works.
With 4?
10 plus 6 is 16, so that divides by 4, but how about 10 to 2? That doesn't work. Oh, no, that works. 10 to 9, so it doesn't work. That was the subject that our last speaker was trying to say, that there's a problem. Okay, but whatever.
What determines which term do you use for each molecule?
Well, whether you write which of these two term things you write out is symmetry determined. If you look at the molecule, or you trust whoever did the determination of the structure, you could say that this is something that corresponds to having cubic symmetry, or having the x and y axes being equivalent to each other, with the z axis corresponding to the largest anisotropy energy, and this says that the x and y axes are not equivalent to each other. Okay, so. Okay, it doesn't work. So what you do in manganese 12 is you, as I explained again, is put a magnetic field on, and in fact, this double well is a bit fictitious. And what you look at is a field for which this level crosses that level. This coordinate here? It's angle, yeah. It's the angle to the z-axis. Okay, so when you bring levels into coincidence, then you can have resonant tunneling, and this is just introduction. This has been seen in manganese 12. This is data from the Grenoble group. Again, you get these steps, which have been discussed extensively by the previous author, and have been interpreted at least in terms of quantum tunneling, although there are hangouts who insist that there's no tunneling going on at all, that it's an effect of lowering of the barrier. But I don't want to get into that discussion. I prefer to discuss the iron 8, where I think things are more clear cut. This is the quantum pencil in quantum mechanics. If I stand this thing on end, it actually should fall over in each direction equally with equal weight, whereas it's clear that with a classical pencil it doesn't do that. Okay, I can set up that experiment rather easily in a nanomagnet. I need to find myself actually with a magnet with an easy plane. That means because of the positive sign here, the magnetization wants to sit in the xy plane. But if I put on a large enough field, I can get rid of that tendency and make the field line line up along the magnetization line up along the field. This generates a Maxicon hat type potential, and quantum mechanically, the wave function localized somewhere near the top would just distribute itself and fall into the bottom of the in the Mexican hat. Well, there are various people that try to propose mechanisms for wave function collapse, in which you put some relaxation into this Hamiltonian, and one of those approaches is called quantum state diffusion. From a simple-minded condensed matter theorist point of view, it's a way of deconvoluting the density matrix with exponential relaxation. Okay, one's used to looking at ensembles of spins in solid-state physics, and with various resonance techniques, NMR and ESR, over, I guess, about 50 years now, the density matrix formalism hasn't been found wanting. You can describe those sort of experiments in terms of the density matrix formalism if you can figure out how to do the relaxation calculation. What these people did with some different motivation, really, than what's presented here, is to show that there's essentially, for exponential relaxation, a pretty much unique deconvolution of that density matrix into something that looks a bit like a Schrodinger's equation. Okay, it says that the change in the wave function is equal to h times dt, so that would be Schrodinger's equation if there wasn't anything else. Elementary quantum mechanics books often tell you can't put relaxation into Schrodinger's equation, which would be pretty much this term, because it doesn't conserve the norm. So what these people do is put in a funny fluctuation term to kind of have a fluctuation dissipation theorem, which brings the norm back up. But this fluctuation spectrum has to have some funny properties, namely this, that it causes the fluctuating field actually goes as the square root of the time, and it's shown that when you do an ensemble average, that this gets you back to where you started from, namely the density matrix formulation. But this, in principle, allows you to describe the motion of an individual system, and that is getting to the point of being doable by a couple of techniques in solid state physics. So you might be able to measure something that looks like this. Okay, this is essentially balancing the pencil on its end. It starts to fall over, so it falls into one of the wells, which actually is at plus 8, the other one's at minus 8, and because it's got a lot of kinetic energy, because it hasn't relaxed yet, it makes a couple of oscillations, and then the fluctuations kill it off, and it just oscillates around the classical equilibrium and ends up being described by something classical. And I think those sort of experiments should be something that maybe some people in the audience might wish to think about doing. Okay, wanted dead and alive, Schrodinger's cat. Since we're interested in magnetism, how about magnetic Schrodinger's cat? Let me remind you what Schrodinger actually had in mind. What he had in mind was a situation in which whether the cat is alive or dead is controlled by a quantum degree of freedom. So a Schrodinger cat, and it's important in the theory of measurements, is a situation in which a quantum degree of freedom controls a classical one. So here, if the alpha particle hasn't decayed, that's, say, a particle up, the cat is alive. If the particle is decayed, that's the quantum degree of freedom down, the cat is dead. So one would like to construct situations in which that is true for a magnetic system, and it's not hard to see why that fits into the theory of measurements with a practical example that might be doable. Namely, if you have an atomic force microscope with a little magnet on the end to detect spins, if you have a spin one half magnet, with spin up, that moves, say, the cantilever up. If it spins down, it moves the cantilever down. So the two possible states of the system are such that the classical degree of freedom, namely the displacement of the cantilever, are controlled by the quantum degree of freedom, namely the direction of the spin. If you measure where the cantilever is by turning on the laser, say, then the system should project into one of the others, but at least when you simply bring the system into interaction, you are creating yourself a Schrodinger's cat, which one might be able to study. You can produce Schrodinger's cats with plain old antiferromagnets. This is a slide I usually use to explain to people who don't know any magnetism what an antiferromagnet is, but what I want to point out here is if you take a bit of a magnet and you count the number of upspins and downspins, they're not equal to each other, so that normally a little bit of an antiferromagnet has an excess spin. A model for that, a simple model, just describes it in terms of two sublattices that interact by an exchange interaction. You put in the anisotropy axis, which makes the nail vector want to point either up or down, and then you put an interaction, the total spin, with the field on the outside. Why will that produce a Schrodinger cat? Well, because normally the total spin and the nail vector are coupled, so that if the total spin, which if you choose your molecular magnet correctly, might only be one half, where the nail vector may be 20 or 30, and therefore perhaps essentially classical, the quantum degree of freedom, namely the total spin, controls the direction of the nail vector. And again, you can imagine building a cat, and there are certain possibilities in which you can control the cat, actually turn it on and off and make it relax by varying the magnetic field and other things. Okay, so that was kind of introduction, what we'd like some people to do. Let me get to intermediate spin, which is a bit far-fetched. Okay, if God had given us anions, we could make anion magnets, and one would have some interesting new physics, or this is the simplest sort of calculation you can do with some anions. You put them on a dumbbell, you have the kinetic energy. There's a certain statistical parameter, which is due to the magnetic flux line attached to each particle. You set up some boundary conditions and you can figure out what the angular momentum of the system is. And because of the statistical, the flux that you attach to these particles to make what is perhaps originally a boson into an anion, there's a shift in the spectrum of the angular momentum. It's no longer an exact integer. The values, the spectrum of LZ depends on the statistical parameter in a certain way. Just in general terms, the spin statistics theorem obviously gets modified by anions. It has to give the two known limits, namely bosons are whole integer and fermions are half integer, at the two ends when either alpha is zero or alpha is equal to one. But in between, the spin of an anion is determined by the statistical parameter. Here it's actually the orbital angular momentum, just as an illustration, but the oops, wrong direction. It illustrates that the spectrum for anions, said spectrum for anions is different from, or the spin value for anions is an intermediate value. I mean, this you can find in any good book describing anions. So you could imagine knocking together, if God had given us these anions, dumbbells, we could imagine knocking together a chain, for example, to make ourselves a spin system. And you could put an S dot S interaction between the spins of the dumbbells, and then you have to ask yourself, well, what does that really mean? You're in two dimensions, so the only good spin operator is really SZ. But the wave function has a simple form, so you can ask, you can pretty much see that S plus or S minus is simply an operation of multiplying by suitable phase factor. That depends on the angle in the plane. And if you accept that, then you have some algebra for your operators, which leaves the usual commutation rule for SZ unchanged, that leaves these two things commuting with each other. Oops, still going the wrong way. Well, God didn't give us anions, apparently, except in the fractional Hall effect, perhaps. But he did give us real spins, and he gave us magnetic fields. So anions obviously break down reversal symmetry, so if you want to have something which has intermediate spin, you need to have a magnetic field around somewhere. I'm going to point that in the Z direction. I also want to reduce the symmetry from SO3 to SO2, so I'm going to put a large anisotropy term in there, which, again, the notation's changed a bit, but it wants to force the spin down into the plane. Okay, and then I've got the S dot S interaction between the different sites. Well, the stupid trick is to note that you can just get rid of the magnetic field by doing a transformation of the operators of the SZ operator. Okay, where the alpha parameter, my statistical parameter, is determined by the magnetic field divided by the anisotropy energy. Okay, you, because of the large anisotropy term, you essentially get this relationship, because all the matrix elements of S plus minus are essentially just the square root of SS plus 1, because this has forced the SZ values down to small values, so the term SZ, SZ plus 1 in the matrix elements essentially equal to 0. Okay, and that's obviously going to be satisfied. Okay, and it's trivial that the new spectrum of this new operator has a non-integer spectrum, which can be tuned by choosing alpha equal to zero to be, well, depending on what I start off with, spins. So I guess I put integer spins in here. If I make alpha equal to zero, I get integer values for the SZ quantum number. If I put alpha equal to a half, I get half integer values. Well, why is this fun? Okay, well, it's fun because you have things like the Haldane conjecture or the theorem due to Loss et al. Or von Deff and Henley that, okay, which is the thing that's most interesting, which is relevant to tunneling, which is, well, tunneling's got some funny connotations attached to it, so let me be more specific. If you have half integer spin, you get no splitting of the ground doublet, where if you have all whole integer spin from the same model, you do get a splitting of the ground doublet, as described by the last author, the last speaker. Okay, and in these theorems, that's all associated with this, or related to this so-called topological term, or the periphase, or whatever. And the value of S that fits in there is what determines whether you have a tunnel splitting or not. So you can ask yourself, well, what happens if I turn on this intermediate spin algebra and look at the problem all over again? And the answer is simple. You get, okay, so there are answers. So this is large spin tunneling. This is the Hamiltonian you already seen. Okay, this is for an easy plane magnet, meaning that the system wants to sit in the xy plane, and then this term, which should actually have a bar on the bottom for k perpendicular, chooses a preferred direction, actually along the y direction in the xy plane. So there's two classically stable orientations here and over here, and I'm going to apply a magnetic field in this direction along the hard axis. Okay, well, that problem's been studied for both whole integer and half integer spins, and the answer is shown here, in which you put the value of the spin into this cosine. If you put a half integer in there, you get zero for the tunnel splitting. If you put an integer in, you get the cosine equal to one, which gives you the full splitting. What you find if you go through the calculation for this intermediate spin algebra is that you get the cosine of this shifted value of the spin, so that you get an oscillating tunnel splitting, and you can actually solve the Hamiltonian directly on a computer and see that in fact you do get the oscillations as a function of the magnetic field. So here you're saying you started off with a whole integer spin system, so you have a full splitting. You go to a value of h which is equal to k, which gives you a statistical parameter of a half, and you have no splitting corresponding to half integer, and then you simply oscillate backwards and forwards. If you start off with a half integer real spin, then you apply the same field and you transmute the half integer spin into a whole integer spin, and it keeps oscillating backwards and forwards as a function of field. Well, this is a bit of a digression about from what I was supposed to be speaking about, but since it seems more interesting from the point of view of what's been said this week, you can play the same games with one-dimensional systems. So here, the difference between the whole integer and half-integer system is that you have a Haldane gap or you don't have a Haldane gap. If it's half-integer, you know that the model is critical and it's gapless. If it's whole integer, at least for h equal to zero, it's non-critical and has a gap. You can show relatively easily that if you put on a magnetic field that the system becomes periodic for this large D phase, as I guess it's called, it's rather for an obvious reason, namely that because the spin is confined near the planes, the states that the spins have on the individual sites are essentially mixtures of low-lying spin states. So without a field for a whole integer spin, the states that are coupled are maybe the three at the bottom that look like this. If you put on a field which will that's half integer. If I take the half integer case here and put on a field which transmutes the spin, then you bring the half state, for example, down to the bottom, and the structure looks exactly like a whole integer spin. So it's not surprising that you would get a periodic phase diagram, so that the prediction of simple prediction from just these intermediate spin considerations is that you would get integer and half integer alternating phases as a function of magnetic field with gaps in some regions and gaps not in other regions. Well, maybe it sounds like this intermediate spin idea is somewhat forced or artificial, so if one's trying to sell a new idea, it's perhaps useful to see that it gives you hand-waving explanations for other things. So these are some rather hand-waving explanations for what can happen for systems without a large anisotropy energy. Okay, what I've just been saying was to reduce the spin symmetry down to something like SO2, I wanted to apply a large easy plane anisotropy. But in fact, for antifermacs, you don't have to do that. You just need to apply a field. And this has to do with spin flops. Okay, if you look in Cattell, they explain that a spin flop occurs because when you apply a magnetic field, you take one of the spin wave branches and you force it down to zero energy. When it hits zero energy, then that signals an instability, and the nail vector flips from being parallel to the field to being perpendicular to it. But you can actually look at it a different way as being a competition between anisotropy energies, that there's an anisotropy energy which is induced by the implied field. So when you've got the spin flop has occurred, as I've shown it here, what happens in this point of view is that the anisotropy energy, which is an easy plane anisotropy induced by the field, is of the order of h squared over j, and that beats out the direct physical anisotropy energy, and requiring that this be bigger than that gives you exactly the same criteria for spin flop. So you can see that and with this interpretation that just applying the magnetic field in the z direction generates the necessary anisotropy energy to force the spins into the xy plane. Okay, obviously if I have a spin gap, I get a plateau in the magnetization. So every time I generate something which has a whole integer phase, if I can do that, which is a Haldane system, should have a gap, then I should get a plateau in the magnetization curve. Now, if I start off with, say, a half-integer spin and to produce a whole integer spin system by applying a field, it should be that the effective field when I'm exactly at a half-integer, sorry, the effective spin at a whole integer point should be zero. Since I've made a transformation involving subtracting off this constant between the effective spin and the real spin, that means the real spin should be alpha over 2, which to move myself to a half integer point would be a half integer. So the prediction of this intermediate spin idea is that when I move a half integer spin, say a 7/2 spin system, to spin 3 by applying a suitable magnetic field, I will get a step in the magnetization, and the value of the magnetization that step will be 1/2. I would get another one at 3/2 and 5/2 and so on, at least if the initial spin half value is big enough. So if I start with gadolinium, I should have 2s plus 1, I should have 14 or 13 places where these steps should occur. Okay, so the prediction is down at the bottom. If you make a gadolinium magnet that's a linear chain, one should see steps in the magnetization every time the magnetic field produces a half integer. Well, the lowest steps might not be there because I need this field that's generated, the anisotropy field that's generated by the real magnetic field, to be big enough to get me into the relevant limit, the large D limit, so you can't necessarily guarantee that the steps are there, but the steps should be there for large enough magnetic fields. Well, if there's really intermediate values of spin, it should be that I can generate something like spin 3 1/4. How would I go about seeing a spin 3 1/4? Well, let's worry about something in higher dimensions, 2 or 3 dimensions, and make a singlet magnet so that you essentially have a set of singlets which are weakly interacting with each other, J and J prime kind of model. If I look at just the singlets, then I know how to diagonalize it. And it turns out, of course, that it doesn't matter whether I start off with integer spin or half integer spins, the singlets are singlet. The lowest value of J that this S dot S interaction will support is always zero, at least if the two spins are identical. Okay, but now, okay, you notice that I did a stupid transformation of the SZ squared term, and whether the alpha is positive or negative depends on the natural axis of quantization in the end of the day. So if I put a field on this system, I move one of the spins, starting at, say, 7.5, corresponding to gadolinium, towards 3.25, and the other one, if you will, towards 3.75. So the difference between them comes out to be 0.5, okay, really all I'm saying is that the singlet the ground state J equals 0 crosses the lowest level coming down from J equal to 1 at some point is how you calculate the period, but this is the interpretation in terms of intermediate spin, so that when you change the spin by 1/4, the J minimum is 0.5, this becomes a just plain old two-dimensional, as I've drawn it, anti-ferromagnet, and has an anti-ferromagnetic phase, and again, the prediction is that those are periodic. There's a gap in the middle, and you can't guarantee that there'll be a step necessarily at the first value of M equal to 1/4, but some of the higher steps should be there. Well, if you can be stupid enough to think that maybe you can see intermediate spin in systems which are made out of spin 1/2, so doing the whole problem is a bit hard, but I can imagine making a periodic strip in which there are J prime joining the rungs together, which is smaller than a J, which takes me around the loop. So I would have for a strip with two dimers, triangles, squares, and so on, and at least for the first two, I know how to diagonalize it the same way as I did at the top. A dimer has J minimum equal to 0, so you have a gap, and this is a very naive explanation of why, as you go from even to odd, you have gaps, no gaps, gaps, and so on. But with that point of view, if you believe the naive argument, then if I start off with the width equal to an odd number, so I start off with a gap, by applying a field by exactly the same argument as one used up there, one can produce even and odd phases and understand why there should be potentially steps, although it's not guaranteed every step would be there, at values of m, which is 1 over the width. Okay, well, that was the bit added this week. In the last few minutes, let's get back to what I was supposed to be talking about, which is iron 8. Okay, in tunneling, it makes quite a bit of difference as to whether, okay, so this was a pause, iron 8. Okay, back to molecular magnets and tunneling, it makes some difference whether the system's easy axis or easy plane. And iron 8 is an easy axis system. It means the principal anisotropy energy wants to spin to point up or to point down. Okay, the fact that there is tunneling, the thing that generates kinetic energy, is the SX, SY terms in the Hamiltonian. Well, I'm not going to be able to say much. Most people like to do these problems with coherent spin state path integrals. This is an explanation for a less specialized audience as to how this term comes about from an interpretation of a Berry phase. But to make a long story short, the normal interpretation of the oscillations that you saw in the previous talk is in terms of this sort of interference effect. So this is supposed to be how interference occurs with a field along the x-axis when the equilibrium direction would normally be along, say, positive z. When you apply a field, the equilibrium direction, the classical equilibrium, bends over to either here or here, and the interference effect depends on the phase going around this loop being equal to pi. So that it depends on, in the end, on the solid angle that this path subtends. So as you make the path between the classical equilibrium change solid angle, as you increase this magnetic field, you can potentially generate other interference effects besides the one that's associated with whole or half integer. One of the problems with iron 8 is that the tunneling effects are often between states which are not classical ground states. Weinsdorfer puts on a magnetic field that takes the two plus and minus 10 levels from being degenerate to the case in which the 10 is degenerate with the minus 9, or minus 10 with 9, I think is the normal way he describes it. Okay, and the 9 is not a classical ground state, so it's not easy to see how you should adapt this formalism to handle that problem. As far as I know, no one so far has done it. What we prefer to do is to look at the wave function, but in a funny way, using auxiliary particles. Okay, so I define some fermions which simply tell me which state the system is in. So I've done a funny thing, which is to quantize along the x direction, so that a given quantum state for Sx is equal to n, whereas the natural axis of quantization, I emphasize, is in the z direction. And you can write out some Hamiltonian for those funny f particles, these fermions, okay, which has a kinetic energy term, which is actually generated. Okay, the diagonal energies in here are generated by principally by the E's. I mean, there are D terms because from the kinetic energy, but the kinetic energy term that connects different sites together is proportional to the D term in there, which is kind of the wrong way around. What's fun is that this actually breaks down in certain cases into disconnected chains with no, if there is no field along the Z direction. But the fun thing is that it actually essentially simplifies down to a harmonic oscillator problem. The wave function on these funny chains that are generated by introducing these auxiliary particles, give or take this oscillating phase, is simply a simple harmonic oscillator wave function without the parameter E, which is the term that normally would be thought of producing the kinetic energy, and the field turned off. Well, I guess I'm not. Let me just say a couple of things to finish. What you guess as a problem for the tunneling problem, which is strange, is a Schrödinger's equation that's shown here that couples site n to site n plus 2 and n minus 2. So you have two disconnected chains, one for even sides, one for odd sides. But the problem on each chain is essentially a harmonic oscillator one. And in fact, if you take the continuum limit for both chains, you get an identical problem. There is no tunnel splitting. There's no tunneling here because the wave functions are all harmonic oscillators, but the harmonic oscillator wave functions give you exactly the same energies. Okay, why is there tunnel splitting? Well, the harmonic oscillator problem on a discrete lattice actually has exponentially small corrections that depend on whether it's a half integer, it's a whole integer, sorry, it's an odd side chain or it's an even side chain. So you have to look for these exponentially small corrections, which turn out to be the tunnel splitting. As I said, there's no tunneling directly, but if you want to look at that approach to the continuum limit, you just take a Fourier transform, and what pops out is good old Matthieu's equation. And Matthieu's equation is just the states in a sinusoidal potential with a regular kinetic energy, and you get nice little bands. Now, since you've gone from real space into Fourier space, and you get k states in this transform space, the k vector corresponds essentially to a site index in the real space, and the tunnel splitting occurs for whole integer spins because you couple only to the s equals zero and the k equals zero and the k equals pi points. Whereas you couple to pi equal plus or minus pi by 2 for spin 1/2. Now, I hope you'll forgive me to show the same data as in the last talk. One thing that wasn't shown was this, which I think is very interesting. What one's interested in is looking at the measuring the tunnel splitting, which is normally very difficult to do. So what Weinsdorfer does is actually to scan through a crossing point at a different speed. And according to good old Landau Zener tunneling, the probability of branching on one or other of these branches depends on how fast you go. So if you go very slowly, you end up staying on the ground state branch. Since this goes from from minus m to m plus minus m, I mean the simplest case from minus m to plus m, you have a rather large relaxation. The spin goes from here to here. Whereas if you go on this branch, the magnetization doesn't relax at all. So by studying relaxation rate as a function of time, of the sweep speed, he's able to measure directly the tunnel splitting, indirectly the tunnel splitting, even though you don't see it. Well, what I didn't really have time to explain, which is a pity, is that there are two kinds of oscillations here. This is the transverse oscillations I showed you in the simulation before when you apply a magnetic field perpendicular to the direction of the magnetization, and that's an intermediate spin effect. You're going from a whole integer phase to a half integer to a whole integer and back again. But there's a second effect. You can apply the field along the z direction and do the same thing, which again is data you've seen before, these again simulations, which is that at zero magnetic field, if I apply zero magnetic longitudinal magnetic field, the plus and minus 10 levels are opposite each other. For a whole integer spin, there's a splitting. When I bring the minus 10 in coincidence with 9, then that's a half integer point, and there's no splitting. Notice this is a log plot, so zeros are kind of, this is a rather good zero, in fact. When I bring minus 10 into coincidence with 8, it becomes a whole integer system again, and I have a maximum splitting. And again, these are the oscillations from that whole integer or half integer point as a function of the transverse field. Okay, so I hope you'll forgive me for running over too long, and I hope I interested you in maybe some of the problems in the transition from the quantum to classical world that you can encounter in molecular magnets. Thank you for your attention.
Other questions? Is published somewhere?
If you look at my name on the Las Alamos, you'll find a couple of papers on this.
If you put your magnetic field on, not in the X direction or the Z direction, but in somewhere in between, the symmetries are broken, and yet in the experiment, you see
that, you know,
the oscillation
seems
still very clear. Is there a simple
hand-waving
explanation for why that is?
Well, an arbitrary field doesn't do it. The Z component of the field has to bring two of the levels into almost coincidence.
Right.
So for special values of the Z component as a function of the transverse component, you see the oscillations.
But the symmetry of the Hamiltonian is broken. The total field is no longer along either the Z or X direction.
Well, that's the problem, that it's not really a topological effect. And if you compute the peak, then you will see that with 5 degrees of line, just diagonalized with Hamiltonian, you will still have
No, I mean the symmetry is still very important. You have to precisely have the right value of SZ to bring levels into coincidence, and you better put the rest of the field in the transverse direction. If you put it any other direction, then the whole thing doesn't work anymore. You could not make the intermediate spin transformation on the Hamiltonian and for either field, and you don't get the oscillations as a function of the transverse field, or at least unless you put a very, very small non-transverse component.
In the one of the applications of your calculations, you mentioned ladder of the already even members of leg, and you have the statement that you take a two-leg ladder of the derivative condition in the grand direction. There is no gap, but I think there's a gap in
there. No, I mean the Sorry, yeah.
There is no gap. You have opened on a condition in the right direction. The gap to the boundary condition generates the gap.
Okay, that's. No, you're right. Sorry, I should have changed the example to be open boundary condition.
Well, there is no more questions. Let us thank the speaker again.